Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, the final weekly update for 2013 here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Yeah, that's a daunting concept. One of the year. Wow.
This is it. This is the time of year, by the way, where the President of the United States very often will issue pardons and clemency, etc. And you know there are a lot of people in the Jewish world and probably some in the regular world as well who are hoping for a commuted sentence for Jonathan Pollard. Might we hear from the President this week on that topic?
I don't know. I don't know what his schedule is. He's on vacation. He's issued a few pardons for what he thought were excessive terms, especially on drug crimes. Here we have a case of an excessive sentence. As you know, we wrote to the president and made a very strong appeal that it should be commuted to 28 years served already, you know, more than 10,000 days in prison for a crime that he, for which he has expressed remorse publicly. He has done everything that was asked of him. His health is certainly not great, and he has paid such a heavy price already for his crime, which he acknowledges. So there is really no rationale, and we've seen in recent days people like William Webster, former head of the FBI, who says he no longer objects to his release, or the more forceful statements by Kissinger, Schultz, former CIA Director Woolsey, so many others, Deputy Secretary of Defense at the time, Lawrence Korb, so many prominent people, many of them involved in his prosecution, who now say it's enough. And that really has to be the message, and anybody who hasn't written should do so. There's an online petition. There are other things that to get the White House to focus on it. But my feeling, as I've said all along, is that it'll probably be part of some deal. There's talk about it being part of related to the release of prisoners in Israel, but we have no evidence that that's the case, and you don't want to encumber it. This shouldn't be a bargaining chip. It's something that's a matter of justice and humanity now.
Both aspects of this are things that would never have even been discussed a couple of years ago. First aspect being the number of people, and you just cited so many of them, who are unopposed to his release at this point. I mean, a couple of years ago, as recently as then, there seems to have been a much stronger, vehement discussion against Pollard.
But they're not just not opposed. Most of the people I mentioned have become advocates for. Right. Webster is the one who has removed his objection, but the others, some of them have written very strong letters and appeals to the president.
And the other aspect
is Governor Richardson was the most recent.
And the other aspect was what you just mentioned regarding possible linkage to a deal or a prisoner release. Again, something that would not have been considered just a short while ago, and now even whether one is for or against it being part of a deal. Just the fact that it's being discussed in that way is a complete change. So
also, it's being tied to the information that has come out from the Snowden releases that Israel was spied upon, Barak, Olmert, others, and they're saying, so you're hypocritical if you are punishing people for spying on the United States or for getting information from the United States. You're bugging the Prime Minister of Israel. So that is something, again, I don't know that the linkage isn't more harmful, more complicating of a already complex issue.
So we heard about European leaders being spied on by the U.S. So it's same thing with Israeli leaders.
Yes.
This week, the passing of Edgar Bronfman Sr., somebody who, aside from his accomplishments in the business world, has always been cited for using his position to help Jews around the world, specifically those in the former Soviet Union. How do you look back at his accomplishments over his life?
Look, when somebody of that stature devotes himself to Jewish causes, as he did, I think it's a remarkable statement, encourages others. He has the resources. He had the ability to get entree in places that others might not have. He certainly played a role on restitution issues, on Russian Jewry, other issues. We didn't always agree on substance, but I certainly always respected him, and his son carries on in Matthew carries on in his tradition, and his involvement with Limud and other Jewish causes. So I think he is remembered appropriately in all of these op-ed and editorials and other things for his unique contribution.
And again, we learned the lesson, although it's blatant with him because he had the resources, of course, to do big things. But we learned the lesson that no matter what somebody does or does not have, everybody has the capability of getting involved at their own level and making an impact in whatever area they wish to.
And they shouldn't be afraid about being labeled as a Jew and that their activities are, quote, Jewish. And too many people shy away because, you know, they don't want to have to carry that moniker. And I think his actions, people like Ronald Lauder, who are so proudly and defiantly Jewish in their actions, Mort Zuckerman, people, Jim Tisch, who have many other options for themselves, and so many others, all the people who become chairman of the conference by the very nature of their accomplishments, they become chairman. And these are all people who have every option in the world to be involved in anything else. And we too often dismiss it or gainsay, you know, it's so easy to criticize. When you have people who devote their lives to these causes, the community ought to be showing its hakaras hatov.
Yeah, excellent point you're making. Malcolm, who's responsible for this morning or today's bombing in Beirut?
It wasn't me because I was sleeping when it happened. but I do think we can safely say that it is Hezbollah because it killed a minister and at least four others, and we don't know the real toll because they haven't even gotten yet to the full to evacuate everybody. It's a very serious bombing in the center of Beirut, the guy who was killed was an anti-Assad minister, a Sunni, and you know, there were bombings against Hezbollah in the last week, so we've seen the escalation of violence that we predicted and talked about months and months ago, but it's really how the war in Syria has come internally into Lebanon.
And one of the people killed was the former ambassador to the U.S.?
I have not seen that. There was speculation about who was they named one minister, but there was speculation about who the other three were, but I don't think they gave their names yet.
Blast Friday in Beirut's business district killed at least five people. Mohammed Shatta, former ambassador to the U.S., was said to be among the victims. And that's significant, right, when someone of that prominence is...
Very prominent, and it will. And the real issue here is that it evokes the counterattack. You know, that this is tit for tat constantly going on. Look what we have in Iraq, hundreds and hundreds of people being killed. In other countries, the same thing. And it's in Lebanon in particular, because you have already, you know, the artificial division, Christian, Muslim, Sunni, Shiite, Hezbollah, anti-Hezbollah, all of parties fighting in Syria so that they can send people into Lebanon. We know that in northern Lebanon there's been violence between groups that's been going on for a long time. And
but if Hezbollah is responsible for today's bombing, this is a pro-Assad group, or this is Hezbollah anti-Assad?
Pro-Assad.
It's a pro-Assad group.
Yeah. Ashata, by the way, the minister, was during the late 90s the ambassador to the U.S., so it's the same guy.
Right. Yeah, former ambassador.
They are. I think that they said there were more than 70 injured, and this is becoming so frequent. The whole region. I mean, you see the attacks in Egypt. You see the attacks in Afghanistan, all over.
The reason
of human life is becoming zero.
The reason I'm hesitating so much is I'm trying to understand the setup here. For instance, the Iranians, right? So on what side of the issue are they? Would they be pro-Assad?
Supporting the guys who carry this out because they support Hezbollah, which is probably responsible, and because they're fighting against the anti-Assad forces, people fighting in Syria against Assad, and this minister has been publicly vocal against Assad, and there were attacks against Hezbollah, people's car bombings or suicide bombings. So this is... the sides here are very clear.
So anybody who now expresses displeasure with Assad, whether it's a resident of Syria...
target.
Say it again?
Potential target.
Right, even residents of Syria. Not necessarily... It doesn't have to be a government official or somebody in Beirut.
Residents of Lebanon.
And residents of Lebanon as well, right. What was the directive given about Druze members of the Druze community, that if they didn't if they didn't declare an allegiance to Sunni, was it, that they'd be in trouble?
There are different Druze communities, but the Druze in the north have been reaching out and helping the Druze in Syria. And there are people in Syria who are pressuring the Druze community there to declare their allegiance. And, you know, the Druze have usually just try to be neutral. They are in the Golan, on both sides of the Golan, actually. And the in Israel, they've been, by and large, loyal. They serve in the army. But in Syria, I mean, because of that, it makes it more complicated. But in Syria itself, they're a minority, and they have been targeted, as all minorities today in Israel, in the Syria, Kurds, everybody, Christians, on both sides of the issue.
So they're with everybody else. If they're not declaring their allegiance to Assad, they're going to be...
But you see how Christians all over are under assault. I mean, it's just even, you know, all the coverage of Bethlehem, and people don't know that the population there, there are about 20,000 Christians left out of the 90,000 100 years ago, and that the First Baptist Church in Bethlehem was bombed 14 times during the First Intifada. And now there's a legal battle. The Palestinian Authority doesn't want to recognize it as a church. And in contrast to it, the poll, the census in Israel shows that the Christian population has increased by several thousand to 161,000, I think, is the number. The only place where the Christian community is increasing and financially in other ways doing well, and the number of recruits, Christian recruits, into the IDF has risen very sharply, even though they're subject to a lot of harassment for it. I think there are about 150 now in active service and about 400 in the reserves. And you know, this is a statement in and of itself.
Hmm. When the Pope visits Israel, maybe he'll take a visit to one of the IDF training bases.
Right.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, and around the world on the web, jmnam.org. What do you think of that terrorist attack that essentially was foiled by, I mean, foiled would be the wrong word, I guess, but it was the action of the driver to evacuate as many people as he could quickly proved to be, you know, a great thing. It saved a lot of lives, frankly.
It saved a lot of lives, and if you look what he said, he just gave credit to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he, very modest, and doesn't want to be a hero, but it was an alert passenger who actually called it to his attention, and then he calmly and quickly moved everybody off the bus, and even before the sappers got a chance to get there, it exploded, but thank God everybody was off at the time. But it's part of the escalating violence. We have to see the total picture. We saw the incidents along the Gaza border. I'm sure you noticed there were rocket attacks from Gaza to Israel.
Has Iron Dome been instituted again?
Iron Dome, six installations across Israel. It is operational. They only use it, though, when it will hit a civilian population. They have a computer which can track the trajectory, and when it's going to land in open areas, they don't shoot it because it's very expensive. Each time you fire it, I think it costs $50,000 or $100,000. So they try to be somewhat careful when they use it. But this is really a big story, and I talked about this for several weeks, about the escalating violence, and because it's not massive events, it's rock throwing, which can be deadly. I know in July there were 82 incidents, in September 133, in November 167, and they're of escalating significance. You have firebombs, you have the stabbing of a policeman, you had other, you know, and the press only focuses when Israel goes after those responsible and somehow tries to arrest them or hold them to account. The Israeli Air Force hit six targets in Gaza, a training camp, a weapons manufacturing, rocket launchers, which shows their intelligence is quite good. But the popular resistance movement was given free rein to move their troops or elements of their troops to the border area because they were trying to place explosives, really massive explosives, And that's when the Israelis shot them. They noticed what they were doing. They warned them. They shot over their head. But what's the story? Two Palestinians killed at Gaza border. And then you have to read 11 paragraphs till you find out that they were there trying to blow up a passing Israeli car. And the so they killed two of the terrorists at the fence trying to come across. And yet you don't see the kind of proper reporting on all this. You think it changes, but it isn't true.
You talk about 166 episodes or incidents in 1 month. So is this being done specifically for this reason? Is it more low key to accomplish something as opposed to, you know, God forbid, you know, much more high scale and high profile terror attacks?
I'm sorry.
I mean, are they doing this specifically? Are they trying to, you know, stay under the radar?
It's related to the peace talks. Every time you have peace talks going on, you have the increased incitement, which is a cover, you know, for Abbas and all these guys in their, you know, to deal with their internal dissension. And there is a correlation between talks and increased violence, because when no talks were going on, the violence was much lower. But the incitement continues in every media, and there has to be some permission given by the Palestinian police, at least by ignoring things or by not being effective in countering it, that that leads to this increase in violence. But this is expected, and we've seen how they've used incitement against Al-Aqsa, supposedly making accusations which are completely untrue, and they incite people on an ongoing basis, and then you see the increase in violence as a result.
What's the world reaction been to the activity in Gaza?
Nobody knows where Gaza is. Nobody cares about Gaza.
No, but I mean,
Israel and Egypt.
Is Israel being criticized for responding to all this?
No. I would say that by and large, no. The regular critics, of course, will attack Israel no matter what. And if you look at the Arabic press, you see how they distort actually what happened. But I would say by and large, certainly the United States and others have not. But you don't see them condemning the rocket attacks across the border, I mean, Europeans and others, when they shoot at innocent civilians. And target civilian populations.
I know I asked you this last week, but it's just becoming more and more evident. It seems that the grassroots effort against the prisoner releases in Israel is getting stronger and stronger. Is that a misconception?
No, there is a real concern, and the concern is that Israel gets nothing out of the PA except more incitement, more hostility, raising the demands. There was talk of, as you know, tying different things to the negotiations, and they just accept each of these releases as something that is coming to them, and there's no price on their part to be paid. There's no reciprocal action that they have to take, and the perception of that spreads in Israel, and also that the nature of those who are being released, when your family member or even a distant relative or friend was hurt or let alone killed in a bombing, and you read that this guy's going to be released, you know what the reaction is going to be.
So will efforts by families of terror victims eventually help the whole process slow down? Will there be less of these prisoner releases and smaller numbers because of people getting involved and hitting the streets with this?
I think it always has an impact, and especially if it's in significant numbers. The Supreme Court in Israel ruled that the releases were legitimate and legal, so the main vehicle to stop it has been neutralized, but certainly the political price on it becomes more apparent.
I don't want to put you in a tough position because I'm sure that you think it's a difficult thing to discuss publicly, but is there any general statement you could say to this audience regarding what should or should not be done when it comes to protests and gatherings on the streets of New York or anywhere outside of Israel, when somebody or a group of people has something to say to the Israeli government? Would you prefer if this is done in Israel and not done in the United States?
Yes.
I guess that says it all.
Look, I don't know what the target, I don't know what the purpose is, and I've told this to them, we've had discussions about it. I think the people here who have been involved are well-intentioned, they're showing cover the Rabbanim, cover the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah who are coming. I think it's great that they come to America and can do positive things, but any event, and they say it's not going to be against Israel, it's not going to be, it's about, you know, the portrayal of Haredim, it's about the forced conscription, or actually the criminalization, which I think is a legitimate issue. But you know how this is going to be portrayed. Look how the rally early this week by one group was portrayed, and I think the outrageous things that were said and the Chil Hashem that's involved is something that people better think about how they'll be held to account for this eventually. But the bringing the message here, if you're going to Floyd Bennett Field with 50,000 people and spending millions of dollars, already raised the millions of dollars, and use it for the poor people that you're coming to help, which is, again, very real concern. I understand the frustration they feel that they can't be heard, and that coming here and showing that it matters to so many Americans is an issue that would make it raise the profile of the issue in Israel. I think that it could just as easily backfire and that people become dismissive of it. And there's no clarity, you know, especially about the draft bill, because some people read the bill and say, hey, listen, this is not so bad. There are a lot of outs here. And others who say, obviously, that any attempt of this kind is unacceptable. So I think that this should be debated in Israel. There should be a coming together. I think Prime Minister should reach out to the Rabbanim. I mean, they should meet. I believe that they can find a common approach. This was an attempt to do so. Obviously, there are issues that I think are troubling in it, and hopefully they can somehow resolve it and also make sure that whatever takes place here, you know, can be a Kiddush Hashem.
Last week, we spoke about the American Studies Association, this boycott of Israel and its academics. It seems that this time, because we've seen these types of boycotts before and very little reaction from the academic community defending Israel, it seems this time there's been quite an effort by many institutions to really get out there and defend Israel and to condemn the ASA for what they've done. Do you feel that this one's been a little different than others in the past?
Yes, and I think some of the credit goes to my staff at the conference who really worked hard and immediately went after the presidents of all the universities affiliated with the ASA. Several have already announced they're pulling out. 53 universities, as of yesterday afternoon, have come out against it and say they will not participate and criticize the ASA. Look, the ASA is not a major group like the Modern Language Association, which is meeting in a few weeks with 30,000 members. They have 5,000. They say 3,000-something are eligible to vote. Of those, they needed a two-thirds vote. In the end, 16% of their membership voted in favor of this boycott, and they have a radical membership. But I think it's important that we got to draw the line. Each time you say, oh, well, they're not important, everyone is important. And by drawing the line here and by getting the presidents of Harvard, Yale, Princeton, every university you can imagine coming out, and many more will because it was a vacation week, many weren't in, that this will draw the line and be a declaration to others who want to engage in similar kind of mischief and discriminatory resolutions and behavior. It's got to be declared unacceptable in America. And believe me, this is spreading. It's really critical. This is the whole delegitimization campaign that we've talked about. I know people may not think the American Studies Association, you know, issue is so important, but believe me, I think this is a turning point. I really believe that could be a very important statement to all of those who are engaging in this activity that you do not enjoy the support of the majority of Americans.
Wow. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency has said the country is building a new generation of centrifuges for uranium enrichment, but needs further tests before they can be mass-produced, apparently trying to counter hardliners' criticism of its nuclear deal with world powers. Under an agreement made last month in Geneva, Iran promised not to bring new centrifuges into operation for 6 months, part of temporary limitations on its uranium enrichment program in return for the easing of some sanctions, but the deal does not stop it from developing centrifuges. Is there, in fact, such criticism from hardliners that they have to go out and make sure that people realize that they haven't stopped uranium enrichment? And does that criticism come from the Iranian street as well? Regular citizens would like to see that continue, or this is simply a governmental affiliated group of hardliners that would like to see it continue?
Wow, that's a lot of questions. So the man in the street does not support it, does not want to go back to the sanctions, imposition of more sanctions. The hardliners, the guys in the Majlis, are being used to counter the pressure in the Senate for a new resolution to say, if you pass that resolution, we're going to pass this resolution. And they have threatened repeatedly that any additional sanctions, they are not going to be held accountable. And you see even they changed the language with which they refer to the agreement from an agreement to a letter of intent. And the negotiations are still underway. We have not yet reached a starting point for the agreement. So this is a tactic. I'm sure that there are extremists who are pushing for everything and don't want to see negotiations or anything happening. But it's mostly to leverage the position and to threaten. Zarif, the foreign minister, did this already a week or 9 days ago, where he threatened that if the Senate passes this, we will abrogate the agreement or we will go off on our own. We will be free to do whatever we want. The answer is that we have to hold tough and say to them, 60%, this is your real goal. Now we see. And we're going to have to take away all enrichment because you can't be trusted that you're not going to increase. And we know that the stock market is up 133% this year since Rouhani's election, that people are feeling, you know, some sense of relief. And if they do that and they take for granted what has happened since because of the negotiations, then the Senate bill becomes much more clear as to why it is essential to send them the message of what awaits them if they continue to play these games of obfuscation. You know, they've increased their oil exports and the income from that. So they are feeling some relief, although the vast majority of the sanctions remain in place. So you have to look at the internal situation. There are forces against Rouhani within the Majlis and within the IRGC and even more extreme than he is. But that does not mean he's a moderate. It means he's just a little less extreme.
Right. A rocket attack killed three members of an Iranian opposition group in Iraq. What happened there? Why is there an Iranian opposition group in Iraq to begin with?
Because they were kicked out of Iran, and they went to this semi-desert area, and they are based there. And you can imagine who was responsible. Unfortunately, with all of the bombings and things that go on in Iraq almost every day, I think in one period, hundreds at one day, several hundred people were killed. And on Christmas, they blew up a church. There were so many incidents going on constantly of this kind. This was an internal Iranian operation carried out in Iraq. But you know that much of Iraq and Shalibi, these guys are all working under the leadership of Iran.
Erdogan in Turkey is, they're evaluating what type of year he's had in 2013. It's the funniest thing. His allegiances and his oppositions or, you know, things he's opposed to, it's like a roller coaster in terms of which countries he has supported and which countries he's been against over the last 12 months.
Yeah, he's more or less alone now. And the guy who said zero problems with the neighbors has problems with every neighbor. I think that the developments here reflect growing resentment and internal divisions. There was an investigation of corruption, and some 50 people plus have been arrested, including the sons of some of the ministers, and three ministers resigned already. He's claiming this is a political vendetta, and he blames Gulen, who's based in Pennsylvania and wants to challenge him for the presidency. This is, internal Turkish politics playing out. But I think his popularity is diminished.
And tell us, it is in fact the last weekly update of 2013. How would you evaluate the Turkey-Israel relationship this year?
And not improved as much as we would have thought by December. He is not allowing it to develop, although on the economic front, you know, there are 50, I think, flights from Turkish Air every week to and from Israel. El Al is now flying again to Turkey from Israel. On the economic trade has increased sharply, but on the political level, they still haven't come to an understanding on Marmara. They haven't. He hasn't eased off on his criticism of Israel. So I would say that you have two tracks: one, the people and the commerce, and the second is the government. The government relationship.
A delegation from a Persian Gulf country recently visited Israel to meet with Israeli officials. Two high-ranking officials were in Israel on December the 10th, according to these sources. Apparently, Prime Minister Netanyahu was involved, but this, whichever country it is, has not yet been revealed. What do you make of this story?
Well, there are visits taking place both ways to various Arab countries who now see Israel as the only hope for them in dealing with Iran. They have, if they lose confidence in the United States or feel America more isolated, they look at what's happening in Egypt, you look at what's happening in other parts of the region, and particularly Iran. Iran is, they see it as a life and death issue for them, as does Israel, but they think Israel at least has the capacity to respond to it. I don't think one should think that there's going to be a major breakout now, that all of a sudden we're going to have, you know, garlands of flowers being thrown at one another. But these exchanges, which, as I said, are two-way, are very important in breaking the ice. And the very fact that Peres could speak to the meeting of the foreign ministers and nobody walked out, I think, was the most blatant and open demonstration of this.
So are we going to see a public display of talks, or not negotiations, but is there going to be some type of public image that we're going to see of Saudi Arabia and Israel, you know, discussing Iran and trying to strategize on Iran, or all this stuff is going to stay behind the scenes?
Yeah. For them, they have their own internal problems. They have the extremists, especially in Qatif. You have the Shiites instigated by Iran. I think any public association would be seen by them as risky.
So not a chance, huh?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing, but not, you know, seeing them embrace publicly.
And the truth is, I don't even know if it's important. Like, you may say to me, you know, there's no reason or there's no necessity. I guess I always like to see Israel publicly have, you know, more friends in the Middle East. But you may say, you know.
Well, no, for trade, for Israeli technology is very important for them. In water, you know, Israel will become water independent, God willing, this year. Israel will have energy and no longer dependent on others. They can do things in that area. I mean, there are many aspects, and certainly Israeli medicine. There are Arabs who come from the region anyway to be treated in Israel.
Right.
So they stand to benefit a lot from improved relations with Israel, but they're limited, and that's one of the reasons they say, you know, get rid of the Palestinian issue, just resolve it, because it's a stumbling block.
Rumor from the Honlein family down in Baltimore, Maryland, that your granddaughter is engaged.
Not a rumor, a fact.
Mazal tov.
To see Moskowitz, it was also from Baltimore, and two wonderful young people telling us again that the future is secure when you see this happening in Via Geffen and all of that.
well, you always emphasize, not just to us, but in so many of your public appearances, you always emphasize the importance of the quote-unquote next generation.
Third generation.
Yeah, correct. In this case, the third generation. Your first grandchild to be engaged, and it must be an extra special feeling for you in that regard.
It is. It's the sign of continuity. It's what everybody wants, and it's why I keep saying that quoting Hirsch and others who show that we're judged by the third generation, because that's when you see really come to fruition the decisions you make and the actions you take. And when you see that continuity, it was like Yaakov Avinu when he saw not his sons, but when he saw Yosef's sons who grew up in Mitzrayim, he becomes Yisrael again. He becomes the strong because he sees the continuity and the future is secure, that not just those who grew up in Jacob's house, but those who grew up in Mitzrayim would remain true to their Jewish heritage and identity in those terms of those days. And I think that that's the greatest reward there is.
Well, mazal tov to you and the entire family. Next week, the first weekly update of 2014. How do you like that?
Wow.
Pretty amazing. Malcolm, thank you. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos.
Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.